From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For those who see shoe collections and shoe fashion as frivolous, the humble sneaker seems like an exception to all that. Maybe it's because you see sneakers everywhere in all kinds of neighborhoods and countries. Seems so democratic. Well, Elizabeth Simelhack says, sorry, but not really. Simelhack is an historian, and these days her specialty is shoes, sneakers in particular right now. And what interests her is how the shoes we wear are kind of a declaration about our identity and where we stand in the order of things. Sneakers, she says, are a minefield of meaning full of social significance. And besides, they're cool and comfy and stylish, and we all have our favorites. Elizabeth Simelhack is joining us today. We're talking about sneakers after the news. This week in Video West, meet the General. He's a friend of Utah filmmaker M.P. Cunningham, and he's gone through a rough patch lately. He's homeless. It's a beautiful portrait of pride and regret. Also, we have a nice short about young farmers, which will make you feel wistful about summer and your garden. Go to videowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It would be probably easy to overthink this. We're talking about sneakers today, and what is there to talk about, you say? For a lot of us, sneakers are just sneakers. They're weekend shoes, comfy and casual, or practical. They're what you run in or play a pickup game in. But really, they're more than that. Whether they should be doesn't matter. They just are for a lot of people. And not just a fashion statement. Elizabeth Simelhack says shoes are one of those symbols that say a lot about culture. They say a lot about a moment in time. And even those of you who might be mystified by all of this, if you think back, you can probably remember a favorite pair of sneaks, a pair of All-Stars or Chucks or Jordans. And sneakers have a history, and it's an interesting one. So that's what we're talking about today. Our guest throughout the hour today is Elizabeth Simelhack. She's a fashion historian and a senior curator at the Bata Shoe Museum in Toronto. She's written extensively on women's footwear, including the history of the high heel, which we'll talk about today. She has a book. It's called Out of the Box, The Rise of Sneaker Culture. And she's joining us today from the studios of the CBC in Toronto. And Elizabeth Simelhack, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so I guess I wanted to start this way. And I need to point out, you came to this subject more as an historian than as a shoe lover, but you've got to love shoes. And I guess the question is, do you? And what do you, just basically, what is it that you love about shoes?
I think what I love about shoes, and you sort of hinted at it, is that I love things that are made to be consumed at the moment of their creation. And so unlike, and I started out as an art historian, I'm not as interested in the unique work of art made by the unique genius, meant to be purchased by the unique forward-thinking collector and hidden on a wall in some private home. I'm interested in things that somehow capture the interest of many, many people. And footwear, fashion is one of those things. And what I think as a historian, looking at mass-produced items, what this can offer is that it allows us to take a pulse of very specific moments in time. And I think that there are memories and nostalgia wrapped up in what it is that we wear. And those memories also link to broader historic moments. And so that's sort of what I'm interested in.
Yeah. I don't suppose you have a collection of shoes.
I have no time to shop.
Right.
Yeah. I have to also say that studying a dress makes getting dressed particularly fraught, because you know that everything that you're putting on does signify something.
Yeah.
I need to come up with some sort of meaningless uniform to slip into.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that you write about a lot, this is one of the things that seems to be really interesting to you, is how it is that sneakers have come, some sneakers anyway, have come to be valued more than others. What is it about that question that interests you? Because one of the things you've said is, and a lot of us think of it this way, sneakers are the democratic piece of apparel. Everyone has sneakers, but you say they're not really democratic.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's true. You can look across, you know, a crowded street and you will see almost everybody wearing sneakers, but that doesn't mean that each pair that you see is as highly valued culturally. And so there are some sneakers that convey specific aspects of masculinity, or they're connected to being absolutely at the cutting edge of fashion trends, or they connect to nostalgia and ideas of authenticity. And so I think that under that broad umbrella term, the sneaker, when you actually sort of focus that lens a little bit more, you are drawn into some of these more complex issues. And so for me, that's what I'm interested in teasing apart is what does someone wearing Chuck Taylor's, what statement are they making as opposed to, say, somebody wearing the latest Air Jordans?
Yeah. I guess sneaker is the best name, right? I mean, but this is interesting too, though. I mean, because I guess it depends on where you're raised. And I was talking about this with our producer. Like kicks for some just say tennis shoes. Some say tennis runners. A lot of people said tennis runners when I was growing up. I've heard keds, just keds to speak of, you know, to mean all
the
kinds
broad
of
range.
Sneakers. Yeah, the broad or chucks.
Yep.
We all have different names for them, don't we?
We absolutely do. And there are different names worldwide as well. I probably in part gravitated towards sneaker because of where I grew up, where we did use the term sneaker. But also sneaker and tennis shoe actually are both very old terms. And sneaker dates back at least to the 1870s. Tennis shoe dates back a little bit further than that. But I felt that sneaker was maybe the better choice than tennis shoe or keds or chucks because those seem to be so specific.
Yeah.
Whereas sneaker can under that umbrella term, you do find you can have basketball shoes, running shoes, you know, whatever kind of athletic footwear you're talking about, and it's not brand specific either.
Well, this gets us into history. This story goes back further than I realized, to the 19th century. And I guess we should begin with kind of the discovery of latex. Just plain rubber from a tree didn't work very well. And
right.
maybe you can start there.
Yeah. For me, one of the questions that I always like to start out asking when I begin to do my research is, how did this all begin? And so, of course, this took me back to the origin of latex. The sap of a tree, rubber, was an amazing material, extremely elastic. It was had a kind of flexibility that was unseen in other properties. And it had been used by indigenous populations in Brazil and Central America, actually to make footwear as well as to waterproof clothing. Europeans were aware of it from the start of the age of exploration, but there was nothing that really captured Europeans' imagination about this material because in the heat it melted, in the cold it fractured, and so it sort of stayed a novelty item, which is one of the reasons why we call it rubber. It was first used to rub out pencil mistakes. And so it sort of spoke to what people thought the value of this new material was. But there were some minds out there that thought that maybe rubber had some industrial potential, and it created a drive to find ways to stabilize the material. Goodyear, of course, his name still, we still remember that name today with Goodyear tires. Building upon the work of others, was able to find that if you heat boiling latex, rubber, and you add sulfur to it, you create a stabilized rubber. And what's interesting about that is that this material, rubber, became, to quote another author, the sinews and muscle of the industrial age. And for me, that's where the story gets really interesting.
Can you pinpoint the very first sneaker?
No, I can't yet pinpoint the first time canvas and rubber were melded together. But Goodyear himself was very interested in the idea of rubber footwear. Rubber footwear as overshoes were already being exported from Brazil to America and were a novelty item were very interesting. The waterproof qualities were so exciting. He thought that maybe he could, he actually believed that he could make everything out of rubber.
Right.
And he felt that although at that point, rubber was so expensive, you could, you know, because it is the sap of a tree, you could only harvest about a cup of it every other day. And so the original original footwear made of rubber was quite expensive. It was about seven times the cost of leather footwear. But
wow.
He had this dream. Yeah, it really was a luxury item. And so Goodyear had a dream that he could create some kind of rubberized footwear that would be at a price point that would be low enough that it would be available to everyone. And he himself never achieved this, but there were all types of experimentations going on about connecting fabric to rubber, leather to rubber. And around the middle of the century, tennis as a lawn game was becoming increasingly popular. We know that the canvas upper rubber tennis shoe was now available around the 1860s.
This does give you a sense of your bigger point. I mean, the idea that they conveyed, at least in those times, these were shoes for the luxury class. I mean, not everyone needed rubber shoes to wear to play croquet or to play tennis.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean, not only was rubber itself expensive, but to have the time to play was a signifier of class. And so the earliest uses of the sneaker was in part to proclaim the newfound luxury of having leisure time. And so we think of the sneaker as being so humble, but in fact, its origins were linked to these ideas of expressions of luxury and leisure time.
Say a little bit about the shoes you have in your collection from this period, because one thing that strikes me about them is the canvas with the rubber is the kind of simplicity. I know they were high tech. They were sort of perceived as high tech.
They were high tech at the time.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, but when you look when you look back at them, they do look so humble. They're so simple. But I think there is a kind of elegance in that simplicity for sure.
And that's maybe why I wonder if they're becoming so. So popular again. I mean, retro shoe styles are big. And a lot of these, I'm looking at some of these from, from the 1800s, and I'm like, you know, those would be cool today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think in the sneaker obviously has undergone a great deal of change over the years. But even looking back at, say, the original Converse All-Star or looking at the original Keds Champion, and you can see that these original styles obviously still resonate with us today. I think that, again, some important points that connect the original sneakers with some of the trends that you see in sneaker culture from the 80s on up is the idea of the all-white tennis shoe or the all-white sneaker. If early rubber footwear was expensive and the ability to play signify that you had the time and leisure to do so, keeping your sneakers all white was also a signifier of status. And as we know from the Air Force One, the all-white sneaker in sneaker culture was so important for the same reason. And so one of the things that I found very exciting in doing this research was to find so many connections still or continuities within sneaker culture from the origin of the sneaker through to today.
It's so interesting when you this seems like a very important element of sneaker culture, particularly in urban cultures, and maybe even particularly for African Americans. The idea of keeping your shoes pristine is really critical.
It has been a central... It was a central trend historically when the Air Force One came out in all white in 86. It was very important. And today I think that it still has that resonance and that importance that sort of links it back to the 1980s. But today, wearing very crisp all-white sneakers can be linked to just a very fresh fashion statement without sort of the heavy baggage that the all-white sneaker sort of had in the 1980s.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about this caught my eye. There's a high-heeled sneaker And not, this wasn't, I'm not talking about a modern one. I'm sure there are plenty of high-heeled sneakers in modern couture fashion. Yeah. But this was from 1925, the Fleet Foot.
Right. That's right. I wanted to include that because although the focus of the exhibition really is on shifting constructions of masculinity in relation to sneaker culture, and I feel that it is a fact that women, of course, have worn sneakers throughout all of these periods, but they have not been fully embraced within sneaker culture for a variety of reasons. But some of those reasons are actually expressed in that 1925 high-heeled sneaker. I think ideas of femininity and athleticism in Western culture also often find themselves at odds. And so in the 1920s, when so many new freedoms were opening up for women, they were being encouraged to play sports, they were going to university, finally got the right to vote. There were also worries that went along with these new freedoms that by doing these new activities, somehow femininity itself would be threatened. And so one of the ways to navigate this complex time was for women to wear sneakers, for example, that had elements of masculine footwear, such as broguing, which is that perforated style that you see on men's business shoes.
Yeah, yeah.
But to add a high heel to ensure that everyone understood that the wearer was, in fact, keeping in line with ideals of femininity. And so there you have a simple high heel sneaker, but it does actually tell a great deal of the story of the 1920s. And I find it interesting that the high heel sneaker remains important today. And I think it's because some of the same concepts remain important today.
But you've written a lot, actually, about heels, the kind of the evolution of heels. And I guess we should point out heels began with men. I mean,
that
as being for women, but that's not how it began. This was
no. That's another one of those. You know, when I decided that I would focus on the history of the high heel, as I did with sneakers, I had to ask the question: where and how did this become an item of fashion? And so my research took me further and further back in time, and I realized that when the heel was invented, I can't say who invented it yet. I think it's lost in the, you know, it lost to history. But it was clearly invented for military use so that riders in the Near East, really specifically Persia, or what is now Iran, would be able to hook their feet into the stirrup, stand up in the stirrup, and shoot their bow and arrow. And it also allowed them to handle heavier weaponry. And so they became incredibly famous for their horsemanship and for their military might. And it was in connection to European interest in Persia that European men first had heels added to their own shoes. And so it absolutely entered Western culture as a signifier of masculinity and military might.
And then in the 18th century, everything shifts where it's for some reason the heel started to be seen for men as too feminine. And one of the things you write about is fashion started to be seen as frivolous and kind of empty-headed. And this was then the province of women because women were seen as being, here's your quote here, naturally deficient in reason. And so high heels were kind of connected to, I guess they were connected to vanity and deceitfulness is also something you say.
Yeah, they were. It is an interesting shift, again, in larger culture where as Enlightenment thinking basically starts to sow the seeds for things that will become the revolutions in America and in France, which was sort of encouraging people to think beyond ideas of absolute rule. And one of the things that was pushing this forward was the idea that men specifically were naturally rational, that any man was naturally rational, and that perhaps citizenship and involvement in government shouldn't be based on birth, but it should be based on whether or not you'd been schooled and you could become an educated part of society. And so in a strange way, although birth was the center of this focus, no longer was it going to be nobility of birth. It was going to be, birth still remained important. It was going to be birth at the gender at birth
yeah.
is what was going to become the focus. And so you have this division between what's male and what's female. And it was decided that men were naturally rational and women were naturally irrational.
Right.
And fashion begins to become a means of expressing that difference. And the high heel at that point gets shifted over to women. And its connection to deceitfulness is one. We have to remember that women all wore long dresses at that point, and high heels were in part used to hide the majority of a woman's foot under her skirts so that she presented a very tiny foot, which was in keeping with fashion ideals of the day. And so it had to do with you end up looking taller than you are, your foot looks smaller than it is, and all of this links to means of seduction that are ultimately connected to deceitfulness.
What did suffragettes and early feminists think about high heels?
Well, one of the things that, as I charted the history of the high heel in the 18th century accrues greater and greater associations with femininity, but it also increasingly is associated with sexual manipulation, that maybe this is the only means to power that a woman might have is whether or not she can sexually manipulate a man into doing what she wants. This is sort of the story of Marie Antoinette. Yes. Whether or not it was true, she becomes the poster child for deceitful femininity. And so after the French Revolution, the high heel is completely abandoned for about 50 years. Nobody wears the heel. And by the middle of the next century, the 19th century, women had been wearing flat-soled shoes for quite a while, and society changed. Femininity, ideals of femininity had changed. And one of the most important shifts was this idea that women were naturally now sentimental. It hadn't been an important part of femininity in the 18th century. And so women, using this idea of sentimentality, who wanted to have a voice in politics and in what was happening in the world, began to work on the anti-slavery movement. And as women were starting to speak publicly about this issue, they also began to realize that they could speak on women's rights. And so as women were stepping onto the soapbox, asking to be a part of the public world and have the right to vote, I find it interesting that it's at that exact moment that the high heel is reintroduced into women's fashion. And it brings with it all of those 18th century concepts. And I think sort of helps to destabilize the movement, which it takes a little while to sort of gain strength again. And so by the time of the suffragettes, they are facing the same problem that the woman who wanted to wear sneakers and play athletics faced in the 1920s, which was, how can I engage in things that are coded male and still remain and still be seen as feminine? And so suffragettes made use of heels simply to express, or primarily to express, the fact that they were not going to cease to be women, even if they were given things like the right to vote.
Well, when we get back from a break, we're going to talk more about we'll get back to the subject of sneakers. We're hearing from some of you. This comment says, the Chuck Taylor's the Stradivarius of sneakers, as far as I'm concerned. One listener says, Adidas all day, every day, the brighter, the uglier, the better. I'm going to start you thinking about some of your favorites. Think about the Adidas Samba and the Gazelle and the Stan Smith, and think about the Nike Cortez and the Waffle Trainer, the Puma Suede. Everyone has a favorite. We have Elizabeth Semmelhack with us. Her book is called Out of the Box, The Rise of Sneaker Culture. She's joining us from the studios of the CBC in Toronto. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about sneakers with Elizabeth Semmelhack. She's a senior curator at the Bata Shoe Museum in Toronto, author of the book Out of the Box, The Rise of Sneaker Culture. So I guess we should talk about one of the most important events for sneaker culture that you write about. And this comes in the end of the 19th century, the invention of basketball. This is big for sneakers, mm-hmm. I guess.
Yeah, so basketball isn't invented until 1891, and it is made for the YMCA as an alternative game that can be played during the winter months that wouldn't require much outdoor space and would exercise or release energy, but not encourage aggression.
Right.
And so it was seen as very good for men, particularly good for women. And it became extremely popular in urban centers because it didn't require large fields like baseball or football.
And I guess it didn't take long for the sport to get its own shoes. And is this the point at which shoes start to get a little bit more specialized? Like the suction sole, I think,
right,
comes around. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Well, I think what's interesting is that you begin to have, I mean, it's building in the 19th century that once the idea that the athletic shoes should be rubber-soled or can be rubber-soled and have a canvas top, then you begin to have specialized shoes for for baseball and for tennis, for yachting. And then when basketball emerges, it also gets its own shoe. And Converse, and we have the original Converse All-Star in the exhibition, debuts their basketball shoe, which becomes and still is an icon of the basketball shoe. And I think Converse needs to be credited, and really we need to look at Converse for being one of the earliest brands to look at celebrity endorsement.
Right.
We think about Air Jordans and Michael Jordan, but the Chuck Taylor certainly predates that significantly. And the signing of the Chuck Taylor name being added to the Converse All-Star doesn't actually happen until 1934. When Hollywood and ideas of celebrity endorsement were starting to happen in a number of different areas in fashion. But it really is the first signature shoe the first signature sneaker that I think sets the pace for what we see today.
When does the Jack Purcell kick in? When does that come along?
I have a pair
of Jack Purcell. Oh, is it the next year?
Yeah. Yeah, in 1935, Jack Purcell, and it's sort of a funny story, was Canada's number one athlete. He was a premier... Are you waiting for it? Badminton player.
Really?
Yeah. And more sort of amusing was that he was able to endorse a sneaker because he had had his amateur status stripped from him because he had written a story for the Toronto Star on how to play badminton. And this was considered to be a breach of amateur rules. And so he wasn't allowed to compete anymore. And the next thing that happened was he ended up having a sneaker named after him that we still wear today.
Yeah. I have a pair. I love them.
I know, they're classic.
Yeah, and very simple. That little
smile at the toe.
Yeah, the little blue smile at the toe.
Yeah.
You write about Adidas and Pumas, for example. They come around I think it's the 1940s, and they come from brothers who just didn't get along very well.
Yeah, the brothers had actually worked together prior to World War II, and they had their own athletic shoe company. And in fact, Adi Dassler had given some shoes to Jesse Owens at the 1936 quote-unquote Nazi Olympics. Sort of an interesting move for a German to give to a competing nation's athlete. And Jesse Owens, as we know, went on to become the winningest athlete at that Olympics. He won 4 gold medals, which sort of helped Hitler's ideas of Aryan superiority sort of flew in the face of that. And so the Dassler brothers, had been working together, but after World War II, they ended up having a very fractured relationship, and they created two distinct companies. Adi Dassler made his company Adidas, or Adidas, and Rudi Dassler made Puma, and both remain two of the most important companies making desirable sneakers today.
It's in two of the periods of history that you write about that really interested me. In the 1920s, sneakers were part of this pursuit of bodily perfection. And then you made a reference to the role that sneakers play sort of in the emergence of fascism. Say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so, as I was charting the history of the sneaker, I wanted to know how it did become democratized. If it started out in the 19th century as a signifier of status and leisure, we know that by the 1930s, sneakers were beginning to be found in the wardrobes of millions. And in part, it was linked to Hollywood's focus on the ideal body. And so weight loss becomes important. Exercise for beauty is starting to become important. But more importantly, nations around the world become very focused on the physical fitness of their citizens, in part because World War I, which had been the most devastating war to that point, had not only resulted in so many fatalities, but science and medicine had allowed many of the injured bodies to remain alive. Hmm. And so everywhere you went, you saw reminders of the physical destruction, the literal physical destruction of human bodies. And so countries had been sort of put into high gear that maybe they needed to have their citizens focus on physical fitness in service of the state. And so places like Germany and Italy and Japan, and then eventually the U.S. and the U.K., began to do exercise demonstrations that sort of encouraged everybody to exercise together. But the purpose wasn't to beautify the body only. It was to be ready for the next war, which, of course, did happen. And so I find it's interesting that at this moment of nationalism, very, very problematic racial ideas, the sneaker itself was democratized.
Wow. Here's a comment from Elaine, who writes, when I made the 8th grade basketball team in 1983, my grandfather bought me a pair of Converse high tops. He wasn't the kind to spend money frivolously, she writes, but he loved sports, and I knew how proud he was that I had made the team. Those Converse are still one of my favorite pairs of shoes I ever owned. There's a lot of nostalgia.
There is.
Connected to shoes, I guess. You must have found that.
What's actually very enjoyable with seeing somebody walk through the exhibition is that invariably, you know, the earliest material, people are looking, they're interested, but then they see something out of the corner of their eye that they wore, that they desired, that their parents wore, and it sort of takes them to another place. There is absolutely a great deal of nostalgia, I think, wrapped up into sneakers.
This from Garrett. He writes, one of the only reasons I use social media is to connect with other sneakerheads. What's a sneakerhead? I mean, are they collectors or just really interested in the form? I guess it's a bit of all of that.
Yeah, I don't think that there is an easy answer or pat answer for that. But I think that is people who are, maybe the best way of saying it is, are fluent in the vocabulary of sneaker style.
You identify the Adidas Superstar as one of the most important shoes in sneaker history. Why is that?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people consider the principal watershed moment of sneaker culture to be when, one, Michael Jordan signs with Air Jordan and with Nike and the Air Jordan brand is released, and two, when Run DMC signed with Adidas and the Superstar is brought to millions.
Yeah.
I think we actually need to sort of back that up a slight bit and look at what's happening in the 1970s with sneakers. One of the most important things that's happening is that the me generation, this is post-World War II, they begin to be focused on physical fitness, but not in service of the state, but simply for personal benefit.
Right.
And so they begin to be interested in conspicuous consumption that expresses that they're into jogging and fitness and things like that. And this is when Nike debuts. And they put out the Cortez, the Waffle Trainer. These are eye-catching shoes. And they segue very easily from athletic purpose to fashion purpose. So that's one thing that's happening that really does sort of is a seismic shift. The sneaker is now becoming an item of fashion. The other thing that's happening in the 70s is that televised sports are now central to most people's lives.
Right.
The television set is in the American household in unprecedented numbers, and people are watching the game on this small screen. And one of the things with basketball that is the most entertaining aspect is to see players using street ball moves and using them. It translates very well onto the television screen. And so what that's doing is it's taking urban players such as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Walt Frazier, and all of a sudden they're being given signature shoes. You had mentioned the Puma Clyde. You know, that was designed for Walt Frazier.
Yeah.
And so these basketball shoes become a focus of urban fashion. And the Superstar, which is the first low-top leather basketball shoe, is a part of that mix. And so the leather or suede low-top basketball shoe starts to define urban fashion, so that by the time you get to the mid-80s, when that major moment happens and Run-DMC signs with Adidas, they're actually bringing what was already a fully established urban fashion and disseminating it to a much larger audience. And so the shoe, I think, does, even today, connect directly back to urban hip-hop and urban fashion.
Yeah. There's a there's a beautiful picture of an Adidas superstar, a pair of Adidas superstars in the book. And what's so great about it, not only does it remind me of when I was in high school, but it also, I love how that rubber used to get kind of yellow to convey, like, I don't know if you can recreate that anymore. I mean, that is what happened to them over time. And it just is kind of beautiful.
It is. Yeah, they do kind of age beautifully. They're a very, I think, sleek and graphic shoe. And at the same time, I agree with you, they age gracefully.
Yeah, it's true. Let's take a few calls from Rex in Salt Lake City. Rex, hi.
Hi. Yes, I was on the cutting edge of that. I played at East High School, and I went from Converse to that Adidas shoe you're describing. At the end of practice, we all used to go down and peel the bottom of our feet off after wearing Converse. You know, just peel those calluses you get.
Right.
And it was kind of gross, but after we got those Adidas, we wouldn't have to peel so often. It was really great. I have to say, that Adidas was quite a step up. Anyway, thank you very much.
Thanks. You mean just in terms of the technology, I guess?
Yeah, in terms of the technology, comfort. You know, my kids still wear those Converse, you know, around.
Yeah, but not to play basketball.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I mean, I'm an assistant coach at Highland for girls, and I don't think you'll see people not wanting to play because they've only brought their Converse.
Yeah, right.
It's pretty funny.
What about that, Elizabeth? I mean, that I can't imagine actually doing actual sports in Chuck Taylors, even though they look cool. But that's how people played in those days.
Yeah, and I think that actually that's one of the stories within the history of the sneaker is that the sneaker has in many ways always been at the cutting edge of technology. You know, if it starts with rubber technology, and you know, when the first Chuck Taylors or when the All-Star came out and then the Chuck Taylor, he was very concerned about the structure of the sole, of the shoe that bore his name. And so sneaker companies have been pushing the envelope, trying to make the best, most comfortable, most athletic shoes. And I think that you see some high points in this. If you look at the 80s with air technology that was being played with, the Reebok pump, where you actually – it had a bladder inside it. And you pumped the tongue and you were able to basically customize the shoe. And one of the challenges for elite level athletes is that shoe, you want your shoe to be as seamlessly attached to your foot as possible so that there's no energy transfer. And so as you can see, sneaker designers attempting to make the most streamlined, the most forward-thinking shoes. My most absolute favorite piece that's in our collection is a Puma computer shoe that you actually plugged into your Commodore 64. And it told you how far you'd run and what your calorie output had been. But this idea that technology can make you a better person, if you think it's the same time as the $6 million man was on TV.
Right.
And so you see these sneaker designers really trying to push the envelope and creating, using technology to make the most advanced sneakers possible.
Rex, thanks for the call. Back to the phone. Cindy is with us in Salt Lake City. Hi, Cindy.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I have to wax nostalgic a minute. Years ago on 17th East and 13th South, there used to be a little family variety store. And I would go there every summer with my mother and buy $5 Keds, 1 year navy blue, the next year red. Good old Keds.
Yeah, yeah.
Those were the only tennis shoes I knew. Now, granted, I wasn't a real athletic kid, but that was my favorite part about summer.
Well, we were...
When I was in East High in Pep Club, we had red Keds.
Yeah.
Or red outfits. Anyway, just thought I'd share that.
Glad you did.
Nothing high tech, nothing computerized.
Well, we used to call them Keds. Yeah.
Keds.
Talk about Keds, Elizabeth, because Keds is a big name in this story.
It is. Keds is a big name. And I think that Skippy or that Keds, as you'd call it, is one of those extremely democratized forms of sneakers. I think that in the post-war period, post-World War II period, in the 50s and 60s, as they say in the book and in the exhibition, sneakers at that point, the canvas sneaker with the rubber sole, high tops for boys, low tops for girls, had become so inexpensive that they were the footwear of childhood, the footwear of summer. And that is only reversed when the me generation becomes interested in having sort of a elite level athletic footwear. Mm-hmm. And so for that moment, and, you know, well into the 70s, those sneakers were everywhere. They were ubiquitous. And in many ways, they really were the most democratic form of footwear.
Garrett sent a note saying, my collection sits at around 35 pairs currently, although I've been close to 75 at times. He says, buying, trading, and selling to get what's that next exclusive pair is a blast. The fun is in the hunt. Elizabeth Semmelhack is with us. Her book is called Out of the Box, The Rise of Sneaker Culture. She is a senior curator at the Badashi Museum in Toronto, joining us from the CBC in Toronto. We need to take another quick break. But we'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about sneakers, about the rise of sneaker culture. Elizabeth Semmelhack is with us, senior curator at the Badashi Museum in Toronto, author of the book, Out of the Box, The Rise of Sneaker Culture. So I want to get back to Air Jordans and the importance of the of Jordans in this story. Let's start with Phil Knight, though, because he's obviously one of the co-founders of Nike, and he plays a big role in this story. What is it that gets him interested in sneakers?
Well, he's a runner. He was a runner, and he was doing his MBA and realized that there was an opportunity. The German brands, Puma and Adidas, have been doing very, very well in the United States. And so he thought that maybe importing the Japanese brand Onitsuka Tiger could could likewise result in a great deal in financial success. Mm-hmm. And they were making very lightweight, very high-end running shoes. And so he begins to do that. Then Bill Bowerman, who is a running coach at University of Oregon, he had been Phil's coach, and he comes on board with the venture in part to offer ideas about how to make the shoes even better. And then I think it dawns on them that they could be doing this for themselves. Yeah. And that's when Nike is born in 1972. And as we know, Nike has absolutely been central to sneaker culture ever since.
But owing to Michael Jordan, he's the one that kickstarted this, do you think?
No, I think Nike was already a huge deal in the 1970s.
The Cortez is one of them.
With the Cortez. Right? Yeah. Bill Bowerman is credited with bringing jogging from New Zealand and to the United States and helping to popularize that. And we know how important that was in the 70s as part of the larger fitness craze. And so I think that when Air Jordan, Nike's fortunes had been slumping a bit when they decided to sign Michael Jordan and debut the first Air Jordan. And it just was the perfect storm of the right celebrity, the right moment in history, and the right shoe. And I think that once that came out, and then they came out with the two, that sets the tone of what's the three going to be like. And so it creates anticipation. And I think that that has served Air Jordan quite well.
Why was it the right shoe? What do you think I'm still trying to sort of figure out what it is about, because I know people have different brands that they're loyal to. You know, some people have an Adidas collection. Some people have, and Jordan's collections are so big. But what is it? Is it what Garrett was referring to earlier, waiting for that one sort of rare moment or that next big thing? I mean, do you think you understand what's at the heart of sneaker culture in that way?
Well, as I said, I think the fact that in some ways the Air Jordans are numbered.
Yeah.
Already creates that sense of, well, if there's a one, there's got to be a two. If there's a two, there's got to be a three. Well, if there's a three, maybe I need the four. So that I think that's a very simple observation. I think in addition, once Tinker Hatfield started, he's the famous Nike designer, once he came out with the three, Tinker Hatfield as a particular designer has been able to really have his finger on that pulse of what is desirable. He has an architecture background. He, I think, is able to translate architectural concepts, ideas from industrial design, and make almost the racing car of sports shoe. He is able to offer at the exact right time the most desirable form of footwear. And so I think that combined, that added to some of the interest in Air Jordan. I also think that Jordan himself, by remaining at the top of his game, yeah, was so important.
Yeah.
Then you got the Spike Lee commercials.
Yeah.
It really started to snowball. And while all of this is happening, culture itself is changing. And so I write about the impact of casual Fridays mm-hmm. on men's fashion. And so, you know, women historically have been obligated, we've had the privilege, but we've also been obligated to make sure that we don't dress exactly like other women. And so while men have had, again, the luxury and the restriction of showing up to a party in the same kind of suit as the next guy,
right,
women are expected to express aspects of their individuality through how they dress. Casual Friday really sort of challenged men sartorially in that they said, okay, for 4 days a week, you can dress like everybody else in the office, but on Friday, we want to see something private about yourself.
Right.
And so if I read a lot of articles from the period, and men were terrified of what were they going to reveal.
Yeah.
And so the sneaker came in as a very important form of footwear that allowed them to link to ideas of masculinity and sporting, while at the same time, through brand identity, create a more nuanced, more individualized aspect or presentation of self.
So this was our way into the system, fashion.
So this is your way into the system, yeah. And so I think that this is happening when Air Jordans are really catching on. And I think that that all together has opened men up to the fashion system in, I think, very interesting ways. And I think they're stepping into the fashion system even today from the feet up.
Yeah. Here's a note from Christopher who writes, I got excited about my first pair of Vans in junior high back in the early 80s. Those classic black and white checked slip-on sneakers attracted a lot of attention. There's one of those in your book.
There is. Of course. How could I not have the checkerboard Van? You know, again, a surfer culture leading to skateboarder culture.
Yeah.
You know, all of these shoes associated with all of these niches is what I think makes the language of sneakers so interesting.
Here's a comment from one of our callers is mentioning sort of the reference you talked about in 1972, how the boom in running shoes really mm-hmm. helped to sort of create a lot of interest in sneakers. Troy writes this. He says, what footwear you choose speaks to your commitment to a sport. He says, if you have one pair of running shoes for all the kinds of running, you wouldn't be considered as competitive as another who has, you know, racing shoes and track shoes.
Absolutely.
And training shoes. And
mm-hmm.
Is that an important part of the story, that idea of distinction and virtuosity?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's the type of shoe that's being worn, the brand of shoe that's being worn, the color combination or the colorway, all of these things add to that more precise statement of self.
Here's something from David who writes, I wear New Balance 496s because they fit. why is it the most popular brands don't offer a range of widths? Poor David. I actually wanted to ask you about New Balance. There's one pair of New Balance, I think, in the collection, at least that I saw. But I'm wondering, what about the American-made New – that's a big deal with collectors nowadays. The 996s and 997s and 574s.
Yeah.
Is that just sort of a newer thing?
It's not really a newer thing. I think one of the challenges with curating is that curating, and this book, of course, is the accompanying tome to the exhibition, is that it really is an exercise in constriction, right? It's you start out with everything that you want, and yeah. And you try to get it. For myriad reasons, the New Balance shoes were extremely hard to acquire.
Wow.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this finally. Is there like a holy grail shoe for collectors? Is like the one shoe or one or maybe a number of these that are particularly sought after these days?
Well, I hope that everything in the exhibition sort of ranks up there as one of those holy grails. Obviously, each collector, serious collector, will have different holy grails. But out of the billions of sneakers created, I only had between 150 and 170 sneakers that I could put into an exhibition because of the limitations of physical space and just what you can actually get. Mm-hmm. And so I think that every shoe in the exhibition and in the book actually plays a pivotal role in the history of sneakers.
I'll mention one final comment from Dave. He says he mentions Ray Bradbury's story, Dandelion, where he talks about buying new shoes for summer, which Dave just recommends because he says it's absolute poetry. Elizabeth, do you know it?
I actually don't. I'm going to go look it up now.
Me too. We'll go find it. Elizabeth Semmelhack is with us, art historian, author of the book Out of the Box, The Rise of Sneaker Culture. She's senior curator at the Badashi Museum in Toronto, joined us from the CBC in Toronto. Elizabeth, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you very much.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover today. The program, of course, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.